Molly has never done this before, has never had these feelings bubbling inside her before either. Something has stirred deep within her. It must be the moon. Yarika's breath catches as her hand gently takes his hair, affected by her touch. The sensation is so simple but so effective. A gentle feminine touch, something he hasn't felt for a very long time. Molly sighs deeply. It comes as an uncontrollable urge. She too is affected by their closeness. She shakes her head, dispelling the magic of the moon and the moment. A distraction she has to find, these urges she must hide. She takes in Yarika's side profile as she works the wax into his hair. "Your features are quite fine. White father. You know him?"
"I don't think my mother even knew him."
Molly nods to herself, absorbing this information. "I didn't know my ma." She becomes a little annoyed at herself. She's never told this to anyone. Her husband knows, but only because her father warned him that she had no female influence growing up and might take some learning to get her behaving in female ways. He meant sex, and Joe Johnson saw to that learning all right, the hard and violent way for Molly, unfortunately. Yarika interrupts her thoughts.
"You got any family?"
"Just my children. And before them, just my da. Just da and me." He would say, "We're all the family we need." This back and forth between them is coming all too easy now. She massages the wax into the back of Yarika's hair. It isn't really working to straighten the curls, but she's trying. Molly secretly hopes he does make it home. She wishes no harm to him. "She died giving birth to me, my ma." Yarika's intrigue pricks in disbelief. From things he has seen and heard about her life since he's been here, it's all sounding very familiar. And now this last piece of information. Slowly, Molly's story's fractured pieces are taking form for him. He looks at her. He knows her. He smiles. "It's you." More for himself now. He goes through the evidence as the facts begin to fall into place. "Molly, pet name to Mary. She died giving birth. Ginny May's visits, of course." He shakes his head in disbelief. "Beg your pardon?" Molly looks at him, puzzled. With his hair done, she comes around to stand in front of him. Yarika wants to tell her what he knows. Was he destined to stumble across this woman's path, landing on her very doorstep?
"That woman who was helping you? Ginny May? She's my adopted mother."
This doesn't mean anything to Molly. "Small world," she begins, but he interrupts.
"On the night you were born, she held you in her arms while your father cried over your dead mother's body."
"Jinns help white women in childbirth all the time."
"Ginny May kept the story alive about her sister's great love for a man of wrong skin."
This grabs her attention. Molly can't believe what she is hearing. Yarika continues, very excited to share all he knows, all that Ginny May told him. This was her plan all along.
"Black Mary, whitest gin around. That's what the district folk would call her. Ginny May said she had red hair and fair skin, but her narrow features were strong. Black Mary worked as a cook for some drovers and Yada was one of them."
Molly looks at Yarika, flabbergasted. He takes the moment to spell it out as clear as he can.
"Your mother? She's black."
Molly slaps him across the face, hard.
"How dare you speak to me like that? I show you some respect and you take all the liberties in the world. You're done here."
Yarika knows he must keep pushing forward with the story with which he has been entrusted, despite Molly's rage. If he doesn't, there may never be another opportunity. As upset and disrespected as he knows Molly may feel right now, he continues. He must.
Ginny May knew that Black Mary's love for the Scotsman was real, and his for her. They kept to themselves because no one would accept them.
Shut your mouth!
Their love was deep as the highest peak to the lowest valley, and as wild as the snowy river.
Stop!
Molly walks to her shotgun, which rests on the veranda post. Narigo, they're your family. No shame in that. She turns, cocking the shotgun and aiming it straight at him.
Take your filthy talking mouth and get the fuck off my land. Go!
Yarika looks at her, desperation all over his face, pleading for her to hear him out. Molly, please. There is no malice in the giving of this story. It's the truth, your truth. I was given it by a great woman. Part of my law, our law, is to share the stories so we live long into tomorrow and beyond. A story untold is a life not lived, and your mother, Black Mary, Waraganj, lived. Lived large in her short time. I mean no disrespect to you or your mother when I tell this next tale, but I also heard a version from an old white farmer. He hired me to lend a helping hand in return for a meal and a place to rest for a while. The farmer told me about the young fair-skinned black woman with red hair. From a distance, you were well and truly right to think she was white, but up close her nigger features were strong. The tale he told went like this. See, the white men in the district gave your mother the name Black Mary, so it was clear to all that she was indeed a black woman, and if they ever caught her, his tone softens. If they ever caught her, they could have their way with her. The old farmer quoted the sayings from others to Yarika. A filly yet to be broke. She runs wild like the Brumbies. Fights like a man. Cunning as a black, though. Yarika, feeling Molly's disbelief and bewilderment, is remorseful at delivering such an account. Nevertheless, he continues. These were just some of the things said about her. The farmer said he vaguely remembered that there was some talk about her being caught by a Scot. His wife had spoken about Black Mary and the Scotsman, but that was years ago, and his wife was long gone by the time I arrived on the property. It wasn't right to take one as your wife, the old farmer said. To have relations with was one thing, the norm to some, but to marry? They'd have to keep that quiet and out of sight. Yarika stands in front of Molly. She is seething at him. He tries one last time to get through to her. Ginny May kept those stories alive, of her sister's great love for a man of wrong skin. She told and retold that story to her younger son, Bulbaray, but he showed no interest in it. He knew it was forbidden by King Jimmy. I did ask Ginny May why she told me the story of her sister over and over, and she simply said, "Someone needs to know." Yarika stares at Molly. Has he got through to her? Those few seconds seem like a lifetime to Molly as she desperately tries to make sense of the many questions racing through her head. Hearing this story for the first time, her story, she just can't fathom it. Not right now, anyway. Not with all that's happened. What good can come from knowing this, known for being touched by the tar brush? And what about her children? What will they have to deal with? She must put her children first. She manages to say, finally, "I need you to go. Now. Go! Get! Go!" Defeated, Yarika turns to leave. But at that very second, through the scrub, comes Trooper Leslie on horseback. His horse froths at the mouth. It has been ridden hard. Spencer Leslie swings down with no grace or style, stumbling, a clumsy hand on his pistol. The horse takes off. He looks very tired and flustered.
I heard yelling. Is everything all right here?
Molly quickly composes herself and thinks, what
more can happen tonight, this blasted full moon.
Good Lord, now she must deal with this. Like a skilled actress, she changes her demeanour in the blink of an eye and says, "Yes, thank you." This does not go unnoticed by Yarika, and he quickly turns his back, fastening the top button of the shirt to hide his scar and the red markings from the iron collar he was wearing at his first meeting with Molly. The very thing she freed him from, and she prays in this very moment that he has buried that thing deep. He turns back to the trooper, standing with his head bowed like an obedient servant. He can play the game too, has done so for many years. That's how he has survived. Spencer fumbles for his small notepad in his top pocket, saying, "Is this..." He finds the information he needs. Maybe he is just hesitating for effect, or the adrenaline of the moment has clouded his mind of the facts.
"Is this the property of a Mr. Joe Johnson?"
Molly, not missing a beat, is warm and inviting.
"A Mrs. Joe Johnson?"
Spencer continues with his line of questioning.
"Where is Mr. Johnson?"
"He's in town getting supplies. He'll be home in the morning, if you care to come back then," she replies. Yarika keeps his head down and stays quiet, trying to figure out a way to get out of the situation. But just as he comes up with an idea and lifts his face towards Molly, the full moon climbs above the treetops and throws a beam of light across his face.
"Mrs.?"
Spencer swings to face the black man, and on seeing his face realizes it is the wanted man on the poster. The man wanted for the murders of the Edwards family, their Chinese house hands, a trooper, and a native policeman.
Good God!
On seeing the trooper's reaction, Yarika knows he has been recognized. He tells himself to remain calm and hopes Molly plays along.
"I'll attend to my duties out back, Mrs."
Spencer can't believe his good fortune. If he brings the black in, it will win him some much-needed credibility.
"Don't you move!"
he orders. Hands shaking, he tries to hold his pistol steady, pointing it straight at the most wanted man in Everton, a runaway, murderous, heathen savage. Chapter 25. Molly's three youngest children lie head to toe in a big bed in the spare room at the McGuinnesses. Their heads rest on luxurious soft ruffled pillows, and fluffy blankets are pulled up high. As if on a cloud, they sleep sound. Behind them, at the window, stands Danny, worry etched on his little face. He looks at the full moon climbing slowly in the sky, then at his sleeping siblings.
"What should I do?"
He's worried about his ma and about Sergeant Clintoff going out there. He was so foolish to say what he did.
"Bastard boy,"
he thinks to himself. But the night is still young.
"If I leave now, I'll get home by midnight."
All Danny knows is that he must do something. He creeps over to the bedroom door and cracks it open to see Miss Shirley and Father McGuinness sitting with a distinguished older gentleman, a man of authority, perhaps. It's Judge Eisenmenger, writing on a piece of paper. As usual, Miss Shirley holds court.
"Judge Eisenmenger, I've never shared those stories before because I could never get a sober confession from her father, but I do believe them to be true. His truth serum was rum. I've always known there's more than meets the eye to Molly Johnson."
On hearing his mother's name, Denny steps away, his back pressed to the wall in shock, knowing that there is a judge in the house and that Miss Shirley, in a degrading tone, is talking about his ma. His ma has never done anything to warrant this from her. His brothers have been better behaved on this visit. Miss Shirley said so herself. He peers back through the crack in the door to the parlour. Miss Shirley continues.
"I heard what people said about that fair-skinned gin with the freckles and red hair. They called her Black Mary and talked about how Molly's father, Jock Stewart, chased after her. Disgraceful, really. I don't see or understand the appeal.
Tut-tutting, Father McGinnis speaks up.
Now, Mother, who are we to judge? Leave that to the good Lord and Judge Eisenmenger here this evening.
Miss Shirley can't help herself. She loves an audience.
Still, mixing like that. Bringing confusion to the children from that sort of relationship. Thank the Lord there was only one. She might have been one of the first in the district to be born of mixed blood, but unfortunately she won't be the last.
Turning her nose up at the thought, she pauses as she adds up something in her head. Then says,
Black Mary was about 6 years younger than me. Yes, six. She was 16 when she was first seen. I was 22, and I remember well the Edwards family was her first encounter with whites. And let me tell you, there's a tall tale there to be told.
Without taking a breath, Miss Shirley launches straight in.
Black Mary's father was Charles Edwards.
Mother,
Father McGinnis interjects, narrowing his eyes to make his point.
There is no evidence to this hearsay. If any man among you seem to be religious, and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. James 1 verse 26.
Annoyed by the interjection, Miss Shirley sarcastically replies,
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
Not missing a beat, she continues.
And if Sergeant Clintoff's assumption is right, that she's harbouring that black murdering savage out there, well then, what is left for us to do?
She pauses for dramatic effect.
Octoroon is what I'd call her children. They need urgent help, Judge Eisenmenger,
pleads Miss Shirley.
Need help?
Denny thinks.
From you? By the sound of it.
The judge finishes his note, and with an elaborate swirl of his pen, he signs his name, folds the letter neatly in half, and hands it to Miss Shirley.
For their safety, the children's removal is authorized.
Denny's eyes widen in fright.
Removal? What does that mean? Move to where and why? We have to go home to our ma. She's waiting for us. Tomorrow we'll be going home. Why would anyone do that? Take us from her. She's a good ma. Does all she can for us. She loves us, tells us every night, and puts up with so much from...
Denny quickly and quietly shuts the door. He knows he has to do something. He looks at his sleeping siblings and then at the window. The pen wielded by Judge Eisenmenger rests on the McGinnis' dining table, the same table around which Molly Johnson's children were fed. In the name of their loving Lord Jesus and their Christian charity, the McGinnis' have given Molly respite and time for herself, like any mother who struggles to make ends meet deserves. She's only human. But the ink spat from the poison pen has the same power as the double-edged sword of reason and law. Tonight the pen did not help but hurt, cutting deep, slicing, severing ties that will be long lost and forever gone. The simple swish of the pen is all it took to wreak havoc, destroy a family. Molly Johnson's family. Chapter 26. The full moon has climbed further in the night sky. Through the treetops, it spills shafts of light over Molly's plateau, giving this heated moment far more attention than either Molly or Yarika wants. With his hand on his head, scars and red welts on his collarbone, Yarika kneels before the trooper. Spencer Leslie reads him his rights.
In the Queen's name, I arrest you for the murders of Mrs. Edwards and her three children, for the murders of Trooper Phillips and the native policeman, Dempsey Buckskin.
Molly is taken aback when she hears this. Yarika never mentioned the deaths of the men. His eyes flick to her and he sees her disappointment. He wishes he had a moment to tell her his side of the story. They hold each other's gaze for a split second before it is interrupted by the trooper.
And you, Mrs. Johnson, I'll need you to accompany me to the lockup for questioning,
Molly knows she can't go anywhere. She won't go anywhere. Her children will be home soon. She needs to be here for them, always.
I didn't know he killed...
Regarding the whereabouts of your husband?
Interrupts Trooper Leslie, gloating in his own sense of superiority. This silences Molly. Her facade drops for a moment as she contemplates what this means for her and her children.
There has been some concern from your husband's work colleagues. He didn't make the drove. They found his horse running with Brumbies. Put down the gun, Mrs. Johnson, please.
Molly stands frozen in the moment. As he looks on, Yarika suddenly makes sense of Molly's reactions to certain things over the past few days. The story about shooting the bullock and how that affected her. The hat Yarika found in the shed, stuffed behind things, and how she fell apart seeing him wearing it. He observes Molly's stress building.
My children will be home soon.
Yarika knows he must do something to distract the trooper so Molly can steady herself. He wants to help her. Spencer's continuous rambling is sending Molly into a further state of anxiety. Yarika knows she will not let anything come between herself and her children, and he must do something before she does. He decides to stand up, risking being shot on the spot, but it's a risk he's willing to take for this woman. He reasons this may be the better option for him anyway. His future looks grim now that this trooper has arrived. He only killed the other trooper and the native policeman because he was being arrested for something he did not do. He'd had enough of this treatment of himself and his people. He'd heard the stories. There would be no trial for him. It was live or die, and at that moment he chose to live. But in the end, was that decision worth it? It was. He's met Molly Johnson and gifted her with her dreaming, her origins, where she began. Yarika realizes that Spencer is not comfortable or skilled in confrontation. His trigger finger might slip. Yarika knows he needs to be careful, or he could get them both, him and Molly, killed by the panicked trooper. Yarika rises with determination, prepared for instant death. The trooper immediately brings his focus to Yarika, as hoped.
Stay down! I will shoot!
Fortunately for Yarika, he does not do so. Perspiration runs down the trooper's face. He becomes more flustered as he attempts to keep the sweat from running into his eyes.
Don't these people know who I am, the authority I hold? First she does not obey my request to put down her blasted gun, and now this black man defies me?
Yarika sees the trooper's angst and lowers his head in surrender.
I can't go with you, my children, says Molly again.
The trooper brings his attention back to her.
I am under strict orders to bring you in. No, my children.
Yarika tries again to bring the focus back to him.
Just take me, boss.
Trooper Leslie is almost at the point of losing his self-control.
Quiet!
His pistol is swinging back and forth between them, trusting neither. Voice strained, he begs,
Mrs. Johnson, please!
Molly has whipped herself into a frenzy.
They need me!
Gently, Yarika takes a step towards the trooper, saying,
Take me, boss. Quiet! Stay down! My children need me!
Take me, boss.
Please, Mrs. Johnson, the gun down! What will happen to my children?
Yarika's own anxiety is rising now. He can see where this is heading, and everything around him slows. Maybe it's a blessing for him as he calculates what to do. The trooper turns sharply on his heels, stepping towards Molly, his pistol aimed straight at her head. Yarika's instinct is to defend her. And as he prepares to launch himself, Spencer yells, spit flying from his mouth.
Shut up, woman!
Her eyes raging with fear and anger, Molly's body is tense and trembling.
Before me, the trooper is no more. It's him, his hat, his fists, the glass shard, the children, think of the children. I hear my soul scream. The fractured images that haunt me in my sleep have materialized. Will this nightmare ever end?
Yarika has read Molly well. He doesn't want her to answer the question plaguing her right now with the action she intends. He sees the tension she has placed on her gun and knows what is coming. He finds his footing and launches himself at the trooper, hoping to knock him out of the way.
No more death.
Bang! A shot rings out, echoing, bouncing back from the mountains in the silence of the night. Molly's world slows around her, and to her horror, the two men fall to the ground in front of her. She's unsure if it was she or the trooper who fired. She snaps out of her moment of stupor, quickly checking that she has not been hit. Then she looks at her smoking gun, realizing it was she who pulled the trigger of her trusty Kalsan Dun. She stands horrified, her mouth gaping, knowing that one of the two men on the ground before her has taken the bullet. Time has stopped. Molly watches for movement among the entangled two. Then Yarika rolls away, springing to his feet. Catching his breath, he stands still and in shock. Molly can only stare at the dead trooper lying at her feet, and as quick as the sting of winter's arrival, she has turned cold, numb. "Bury him deep," she tells Yarika. Chapter 27. The first full moon of winter has climbed higher in the night sky. It's an hour or so off midnight. A small flickering flame dances in the fire pit before Molly. She stares vacantly at it, her shawl wrapped tightly around her. She holds herself in shock. Her broom and shotgun are beside her, and the ground before her has been swept. There is no sign of the struggle with the trooper, the day's comings and goings erased. His blood has been covered up, and all traces of him are gone, and the night's silence is broken only by the pleasant crackling of burning wood. The full moon shines down serenely on Molly. Somewhere overhead, the powerful owl calls, and Molly looks up and out into the darkness. The moon's beams now spotlight the branches of the snow gums, rendering the trees like spirits caught in time. She stares harder into them, as if she has seen something. Molly moves to reach for a shotgun but changes her mind as she investigates, her shawl falling away. She stops in her tracks, mesmerized by whatever has caught her eye. Her breath catches as she sees the young, fair-skinned Aboriginal woman with the red hair, the woman who was with her under the water, the woman Molly reached for, but it was Molly who was swept away before she could take hold. She almost glows in the moonlight, holding something in her arms. Molly's eyes find focus, and she sees that the woman is holding two swaddled, dead babies. Are these Molly's dead babies? Little Jack and Daisy? Who is this woman? Was Yarika's story of the Aboriginal woman called Black Mary true? Is this her? Molly does not move or speak. Neither afraid nor threatened, she's simply caught in this hauntingly beautiful moment. Her breasts start to leak milk. A warmth starts from deep within her. Her motherly instincts ignited by the sight of this fair-skinned, red-haired Aboriginal woman and the swaddled babies.
Is this my mother? Mary?
A cloud crosses the full moon, fracturing its shining beams, and the woman and the babies are gone. Breathlessly, Molly calls, acknowledging, "Mary?" Only the sounds of nature fill the night, and again, the call of the powerful owl. The warmth Molly felt is replaced with emptiness. For a split second, she felt whole, complete.
Not alone. Her ma was here.
She could have sat in that moment forever. A gentle, "Mrs.," comes from behind her. Out of the darkness, Yarika appears, leaning the shovel against the side of the shanty. He has buried the dead trooper deep, as ordered. Molly doesn't look at him. He continues slowly over to her, talking gently as he goes, so as not to scare her.
You all right, missus?
Molly stands in the middle of her front yard, wet patches on the fabric of her dress, her breast milk flowing freely. She is too caught up in what she's just experienced to realize what is happening. The cloud clears the full moon and its beams shine on Molly, bringing her back. She becomes aware of her leaking breasts, which she quickly covers with her hands as she moves to grab her shawl and shotgun. Taking them, she runs inside, embarrassed, and closes the door behind her. Yarika watches after her. He isn't sure how to respond. Women's business is not my place, but I can't leave her. Something is terribly wrong for her to shoot a man of the law. That's not the Molly Johnson I know and respect. That's a woman deeply hurt and distressed. A woman extremely traumatized. That's a big hurt she's feeling, and overwhelmingly painful to contemplate. But I also know it's for the best, for both of us. The thought of leaving her tears at my heart. Come out, Molly, and stop me. Say you need me to stay. To protect you. Yarika waits, but there is nothing, not a sound from inside. And then he chuckles to himself. As if Molly Johnson would say that.
That's Molly Johnson, a drover's wife. She's been fending for herself most of her life. All her life. She's not going to stop now.
Unseen by Yarika, Molly peers through one of the cracks in the wall from inside, desperately holding herself back from undoing the latch to her front door. She wishes he would just leave before she does something foolish, like running into his strong arms and holding on forever. If she allows herself to do this, what will it mean? To herself, her children, him, their lives? She pinches her forearms, hard, to snap these silly ideas from her head. She needs to think. She needs to get rid of him. It's too dangerous to have him here. Finally, she thinks of something that will make him leave. It will hurt him deeply and get him hanged if he is caught. But he'll survive. He'll get home. He'll make it. She believes that. She has to. Yarika makes as if to leave, but stops himself and looks back at the house one last time, hoping, waiting for nothing. There is no movement from inside. Time for him to leave. His steps are slow and labored, but as he reaches the old wood heap, the front door opens and Molly steps onto the veranda, her bravado back, her shawl wrapped tightly around herself, holding herself at bay. Yarika turns back hopeful. There's an awkwardly long pause, each waiting for the other to speak. Finally, Molly breaks the silence. You'll be me saving grace if I can blame you for all of this. The trooper? My Joe? Yarika is taken aback by the audacity of her request. But then it hits him. Molly has brought her husband's name into it. I'm sorry, but my children, they need me. They need their ma. Yarika stands dumbfounded. I'd never just kill for the sake of it, but fight for my children, fight for my life, I will. Make no excuses for it. Is that what you did with your Joe? It's all beginning to make sense for Yarika. The question almost brings Molly undone. Her effort to keep the secret hidden from others, but more so from herself, so life can be normal for her children. And the enormity of holding it in makes her buckle under the weight of being asked this simple, caring question. It has a profound physical effect on her, and she grabs at the rail to steady herself. Her face softens. She breathes deeply, and then it all comes flooding out. I buried his boots beside him, under the wood heap. He can't bury a man without his boots. Yarika hears her perfectly, but does not make a fuss about what she is saying. He looks down at the old wood heap, and it's obvious now that the dirt mound is a grave. He looks back at her, asking, "Joe is there?" and pointing to the mound. "The children were going to be up soon. It's shallow, that's why the mound's there. Just stack the last of the wood on top. Alligator foot off the wild dogs that came digging. Smell wasn't too bad, depending on which way the wind was blowing. But there's always something dying around here." Sensing this is what she needs, Yarika remains quiet and gives her his full attention. "He's buried there with his boots beside him. Take them." Yarika is unsure of what to say. Molly continues, "Less attention to you if you're wearing boots." "No, thank you. Might give you a chance if you stopped. Use your white name." He does not mean to, but he looks at her disapprovingly, and Molly sees it. "Whatever you got to say or do to stay alive, that's how I see it." Silence falls, but the easiness between them remains. They move a little closer to each other. He can see that a weight has been lifted from her. The burden of the death of her husband has been released. No judgment made, just the understanding of two people who have suffered at the hands of others. Yarika isn't interested in details of how she did it. He kind of guesses, understanding why. He's relieved he's helped her to rid herself of the guilt. She looks out into the night. With her guard coming down, maybe he could ask now. Would she think him foolish? He swallows hard, emotion caught in his throat, and whispers, "Come with me." Yarika's question snaps Molly back to reality fast. Her peace is short-lived as she realizes what he is asking. "Become a black?" she asks in disbelief. "You are, and you know it." Molly isn't sure how to respond, but Yarika doesn't give her time to answer. "That's why Ginny May was there for you. She is your family, your children's family." "It's hard enough being a woman, let alone a black woman," Molly says, frustrated by him and his ludicrous question. "Or is it?" She heads inside, but leaves the door open, which encourages Yarika to keep talking. He gives her directions to where he will be holding up for the winter. A cave, northeast, 2.5 days' walk from here. If she chooses to follow him, she'll come to the great waterhole, where she needs to keep to the right. He tells her she'll hit a ball patch, like someone cleared a perfect circle. "Keep to the left of that. A little further on, there's 3 big boulders. They look like emu eggs. It's there, just beyond them. The cave. Food, blankets, shelter, and in the spring, people. Your people." There's silence as he hopes for a positive response. "That's where I'm heading. I'll be there." Silence again. Nothing comes from Molly inside the shanty. It's time for him to go. He can't push his luck any further. He starts off again, but Molly calls from inside.
"The boots. Please take them. For your safety."
She comes to the veranda, clears her throat and whispers, "You're a good man. Please." She looks beautiful and so vulnerable that Yarika can't help but oblige her. He heads back towards the mound. Molly points to where the boots are buried and he starts to dig. He doesn't have to dig too deep before he feels the boots and pulls them out. He holds up the left one and sees that the heel is worn down, just as Danny described. He takes them over to the log by the fire pit, dusts them down and pulls them on. Molly can't watch. It's all become too much for her. She's almost sick with emotion. She heads back inside but leaves the front door open again. Yarika watches her go and reads the open door as an invitation, perhaps. Is he getting to her? Can he try another way to win her over? He just wants her to say she'll catch him up with her children. Yes, that's it. The children. He knows how to win her over.
Can I call on Danny, say, in 6 months' time? He asks. Molly stays inside but calls.
Please, it's too dangerous.
I can take Danny on his first kill with his spear.
Molly comes out onto the veranda with a small food package wrapped in cloth and tied with string. The sight of Yariku in the moonlight takes her breath away. With the boots on, he cuts a fine figure. She takes a moment to steady herself, then steps from the veranda and goes to him. There's been enough killing around here to last us all for a very long time. She hands him the package and quickly steps away, putting distance between the two of them, not trusting herself. She heads out into the yard, looking up at the full moon.
Sure is playing havoc with my mind and emotions tonight. Thinking men's business?
I promise, Danny, says Yarika.
And I can take you and your daughter on a walk. Where the snowy starts to widen, there's these beautiful wildflowers. Should be blooming by then.
Molly turns to face him. He stands right behind her. Their eyes lock, sensual tension thick between them. A man and a woman, no divide, standing in the truth of the moment. There's a glint in Molly's eyes. Has she had a change of heart? Is he reading her right? Molly can't believe they have got to this point.
Oh, what the hell is happening?
She wants to speak her mind about what can't happen and what shouldn't happen, but all that escapes her lips in a breathless whisper is,
Yarika. She said my name.
He's won her over. He can't help but smile on hearing his name on her lips.
Her lips. Perfect.
He inches forward. Nothing else matters. Nothing can take this moment from them. His hand reaches for her, unsure, hesitant, then falls away.
Damn it. I can't move. Do I really want to walk away?
Their breathing becomes shallow. Yarika steps forward again, and his face drops to hers.
Her lips.
Brave of him to make a move, but he will wait for her now. All the awkwardness of a first-time lover's encounter. Molly finally shifts her head ever so slightly towards him.
There it is,
Yarika thinks. Should he kiss her now? A gruff voice speaks from the dark of the shanty.
There's been enough killing around here, eh? So I've heard. And I'm betting you two might know a little more.
Yarika spins to face whoever this is. Molly steps aside to see a rugged stockman, built like a bullock, with a full red beard, standing in the doorway of her shanty, full of bravado, his rifle in hand. Yarika moves to step forward.
Don't move, you black bastard! I'll put a bullet through your fucking head.
Molly boldly steps forward and says,
State your business.
The stockman moves from the veranda and crosses the yard to them, shotgun in hand.
A drive with Joe, except this drove he didn't show. First time in 8 years, and I felt obliged to drop by and see if me old mate's all right.
Yarika's eyes haven't moved from the stockman. His stance is wide and sturdy, and he's ready to pounce and defend if need be. But he must be careful. The stockman continues right in Molly's face.
And on hearing what I just heard, I'm more than a little worried. No need to be, Mr. Parson. Robert Parson. No need for your concern, Mr. Robert Parson.
Parson takes in Yarika's appearance.
Who the fuck did you kill to get them clothes?
He steps up to Yarika, and the two men lock eyes, inches from each other's faces.
You dare look a white man in the eye, Jackie?
Yarika diverts his gaze to the ground immediately, not wanting to start any trouble. But he's well aware and prepared for it. He knows how to play the game. He has to, for both their lives.
I find your facial expressions inappropriate for a nigger.
With that, Parson knees Yarika in the balls, hard. Yarika falls to the ground, and Parson sees that the Aboriginal man has Joe's boots on. He recognizes the worn-down heel.
You're wearing Joe's boots, you bastard!
Parson takes aim at him. Molly propels herself over Yarika.
No, wait! I gave them to him for the work he did. Get off him! You got no shame, you harlot!
Molly gets up, full of fight.
I beg your pardon.
Yarika, still recovering from the kick to his balls, lies on the ground in great pain, hoping that Molly's reaction won't provoke the stockman to end both their lives.
You heard me. Now where's my mate? Where's Joe?
Parson asks Molly.
Gone. Left me. All alone with the children. No food, no nothing. And my wee one dead, dead from all the worry. This man offered to help, and I needed help, and for his time I gave him Joe's boots. Well, what the fuck's Joe got on his feet? Not my concern. I found him in a compromising position with the whore Due West. Riding him she was, and it wasn't fucking side saddle.
Parson bursts out laughing. Molly's not sure where this is going. Yarika has partly sat up now, still in pain. Parson continues laughing as he walks towards Molly. He gets up in her face again, becoming deadly serious, dead fast.
I don't believe a fucking word you say. See, I found your Joe's horse running with Brumbies. As you should know, losing your horse is a sure sign something ain't right.
Molly is riveted to the spot. Is it out of fear or bravado? Parson continues.
A man from these parts goes nowhere without his horse, hat, and boots. Unless he's dead, of course.
Joe Johnson lies dead and rotting no more than a few feet away. Molly and Yarika both know it, but give nothing away. Parson's gaze shifts from Molly to Yarika. Has he called their bluff? He can't believe the audacity of the woman, standing before him eye to eye.
Doesn't this bitch know her place?
Despising her for it, he raises his rifle and stabs her hard in the ribs. Something cracks and Molly gasps with the pain and stumbles back. Parson follows through with a backhander, sending her stumbling further across the yard. Yarika struggles to get up. Parson takes aim at him and pulls the trigger, but the shotgun jams. This gives Yarika a chance. It is now or never, and he throws himself at Parson. The two men wrestle, twisting and turning across the yard towards the fire pit. Parson has the upper hand as Yarika is still recovering from the kick to his groin. Parson headbutts Yarika, dazing him and forcing him further back, stumbling over the log. He falls flat on his back, and Parson brings the butt of his rifle down hard, slamming it into Yarika's face repeatedly. Yarika's legs twitch with the repeated hits to his face. Then he is still, his legs dangling lifeless over the log. Parson catches his breath, sucking hard to take in oxygen. Molly has managed to get up slowly, and just as Parson pauses to check his rifle or perhaps reload to shoot Yarika dead, she throws herself at him and wrestles for it. Not wanting to take his hands off his gun, he headbutts her, sending her to the ground. Dazed, Molly lies foxing, giving herself time to work out her next move, to help herself and Yarika. She has to think quick and sensibly. They could still both end up dead. What can she say or do to turn this around?
Think, woman, think.
There is movement behind her, and she turns slightly. To her horror, she sees another, younger stockman. It's John McFarlane. He steps into the cleared area of the front yard.
Is he wearing a woman's skirt? What kind of fool is he? What is this in aid of?
John McFarlane holds one of Yarika's killing spears.
Look at this!
He yells. He jumps up on the chopping block and starts to dance around, mimicking an Aborigine. He chants, but his words mean nothing. Just a lot of gibberish. It is a crude, degrading display. McFarlane laughs at himself, showing his rotten teeth. He finally stops his tomfoolery and looks around. He realizes something has happened here.
Where's Joe?
He asks, then calls.
Joe, we brought your horse back.
Parson shakes his head, still finding his breath. He manages to get out, pointing towards the log.
Rope this black bastard up.
McFarlane peers over the log and gives a yelp of joy at the prospect of having a black man at his mercy. He drops the spear and, pulling a rope from his belt, takes Yarika's legs and binds them.
How many will he make?
38.
Is that all?
I'm not getting paid.
Molly has been watching. She works to calculate her next move. Red welts marking her face. Snot and blood streaming from her nose. McFarlane stops what he is doing and takes a closer look at the left boot with the worn heel.
Hey, Joe's boots!
Parson waves the comment away as he heads to the water barrel and draws himself a drink.
What took you so long?
Had to take a shit.
Molly looks at the spear, but it lies too close to McFarlane. Then she sees the axe at the base of the chopping block. Yarika removed it when he sat for Molly to do his hair. If only she had simply said yes to going with him, would they have been in a less vulnerable state? They may have seen or heard the stockman coming, giving them time to prepare for this attack. But what good is should have, could have now? She slowly rises, as quietly and as stealthily as she can, even though her broken ribs pain her greatly. She steadies herself, then lunges with all her might at the axe. Sweeping it up, she lets out an almighty guttural, "Aah!" Molly doesn't see it, but from behind the snow gum, there is movement. Someone is there. Is it help? Is it Sergeant Nate Klintoff? Is he planning his move to intervene? It's Danny, sweat running from his brow. He tries to catch his breath as quietly as he can. He has just arrived from the McGinnises. Hearing the ruckus, he ditched his horse and silently made his way up to the old snow gum and hid behind the womanly curves of its trunk. He watches his ma and the men, deeply confused as to what has happened, but more so why it is happening. The men look vaguely familiar, although it's hard to tell as they have their hats pulled low, casting shadows across their faces. He has ridden out a couple of times to see his da off and thinks they might be the men his da works with. But with only the moonlight to light their faces, he is unsure. Danny watches them run either side of his ma and position themselves behind her, laughing at her attempt. He watches as she struggles to keep the axe aloft, her breathing shallow and rapid. He feels her pain. He hears Parson say, "Put it down, or I'll put a bullet through you." Danny sinks to the base of the gum, frozen with fear. He wraps his arms around his legs and pulls them tight to his chest, praying for his ma to do as the man asks. He hears the same man say, "You're a fucking disgrace, risking everything for a black." Danny takes a quick look and sees where Parson is pointing. Behind the log, he sees the legs of the gentle, caring, and honourable man he knows as his friend. He is fearful that Yarika may already be dead. Blacks can be shot on sight out here. Danny has become very emotional and is totally at a loss as to what to do. Then he hears what the other man, McFarlane, says next, and a cold chill runs through him as if death itself has sat down beside him.
"You gonna shoot her?"
Danny's eyes fill with tears. Parson mumbles something, but Danny can't make it out. The silence gets the better of him and he takes another look. With his mother releasing a gut-wrenching, "Ah!" Danny sees her bury the axe deep into the chopping block, surrendering. The fear in Danny has paralysed him. He bites down hard on his bottom lip, so hard that he draws blood. He closes his eyes tight and tears stream down his cheeks. He turns away, unable to bear witness to what might happen next. He hears scuffling as the men move about, but doesn't want to open his eyes. He's too afraid. He's walked into his worst nightmare. He thought what he witnessed with his own da and what his da did to his ma in his drunken rage was bad. But this here tonight? He hears his ma begging, "My children, please, my children." With tear-filled eyes, snot running from his nose and blood seeping from his lip, Danny peeks around the tree trunk again. He wants to run to his mother and protect her, like he tried to all the other times with his father. but he knows he is no match for these men. But one day I will be. The man with the red beard grabs his ma and delivers punch after punch to her face. After the first punch, Molly is numb to the pain. She only feels the impact to her body, the jolt of the force, fist to bone. There's a slight twinge of pain if he punches in the same spot or over her open wounds. He finally lets her go, and she falls to the ground like Delphi's rag doll. Falling on her broken ribs, she can't take any more, and fleetingly, and for the first time in her life, she wishes death would take her. The other man strides towards her, baring his rotten teeth. He spits on his hand, burying it down the front of his pants, and plays with his cock, arousing himself. He kicks at her legs, making space, then lowers himself on her, ripping at her undergarments. Danny, traumatized, can't watch anymore. He turns away, placing his hand over his mouth to stop any noise escaping. McFarlane plunges himself deep into Molly, raping her. Danny runs. Like a startled hare, he bounds off into the night, and the powerful owl's haunting call echoes around the mountain range. The full moon sits directly above. It's just on midnight. An eeriness hangs in the air. Danny stands stock still in the middle of the front yard, staring straight ahead at Yarika hanging from the snow gum, silhouetted by the full moon, his Dar's boots only an inch from the ground. Yarika's face is the ash grey of death. The white branches are outstretched like spirits stilled in their escape. It's beautiful and devastating. Behind Danny there is a noise. It's Molly stirring. She realizes there is someone beside her and, jumping with fright, scurries away. The boy stays mesmerized by death hanging before him. Molly finds her focus and realizes it's her son. She follows his gaze, her swollen, tear-streaked face stained with dry blood, snot, and dirt. Numb of any emotion, she stares at Yarika's lifeless body, hanging still and stiff. After a moment, Danny speaks.
He dead, Ma?
Molly says nothing but blinks a few times, trying to find her thoughts. Danny can't take his eyes off his dead friend. Silence. Nature mourns this moment, deathly silent. Then ever so softly, the sound of the creaking rope. The rope is very short. Yarika's neck is jammed up against the branches of the stout tree. The sturdy tree's limbs outstretched, waiting to take the weight of winter, the weight of you.
Two of your Dar's mates stopped by this evening. They brought word about your Dar.
They did this.
Not a question, but a knowing.
On the drove, up in the high country, your Dar's horse slipped.
Stop, Ma!
Hitting his head, dead, something like that.
Molly hates herself for her lies and fights to hold back tears.
No, Ma!
It has to be.
Stop! I know, Ma!
Know what, son?
Not your fault, though.
Molly stares at him, confused, as Danny continues.
Not a very happy night for my birthday.
The boy is numb to the horror, numb to all of it, emotionally drained. He takes his mind back to his birthday night, the night before his Dar was to leave for the drove. His ma had promised a family dinner to celebrate the birthday of her eldest son. Turning 12 was important, she believed, and she wanted to do something nice for him. All the children were in bed. The younger ones were sound asleep, but Danny could never sleep on nights like tonight because he knew all too well that after his Dar got his belly full of whiskey, he would start on his ma. And tonight, there was plenty for his Dar to be angry about. Times before, his Dar didn't need a reason to start on his ma, but tonight, his Dar felt like he had all the reason in the world to lash out at her for her behaviour earlier in the day. His Dar's repeated mumbling and yelling coming from outside had Danny sitting on the edge of his bed the whole time. He wished his father would just go to sleep.
Shaming me manhood in front of a whore!
His Dar yelled clearly from time to time. Joe couldn't and wouldn't let it go. Molly was just sitting there. She had tried a few times to go to bed, but he held her there, laying his leg across her lap so she didn't dare move for fear he would ram it into her pregnant belly. She was 6 months pregnant, Carrie and small. She had told him, because normally he'd leave her alone. Earlier in the night, he'd sat down beside her, a sure sign he was looking for a fight. She'd attempted to get up and address a need of one of the children, but he grabbed her by the arm, ripping her back. His other former torment had been a headbutt to the temple. Dazed, she would sit straight back down. The headbutt she hated, because she never saw it coming and she could never brace for the impact. But tonight, something wasn't right. Denny could feel it. He was up and out of bed, peering through a crack in the wall. Joe was a brute of a man, tall and robust. He had his hat pulled low, casting a shadow over his face. He was very drunk, and his actions were slow and unstable. He stood over the chopping block with a bottle of whiskey in his hand, swallowing the last of its contents. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and smashed the bottle hard against the block. The last remnants of whiskey ran down the side of the block, staining it like blood. Denny comes out of his thoughts and sits on the ground beside his ma. He shakes the image from his mind and turns to Molly, but she is too guilt-ridden to look at him. Gently, Denny says,
"He was coming for you, ma. Tha was coming to kill you."
The memories are too strong, and his mind goes racing back. The drover, with a jagged glass shard from the bottle in his hand, staggered towards a petrified Molly. Denny moved to find another crack in the wall so he could see his mother clearer. She clung to her shotgun, her body trembling all over, her face bruised.